Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. My name is Ron Yates, the Dean of the College of Media at the University of Illinois, and I'm here sitting in for David Inge, who's away on vacation. Today we're talking about good journalism. Is anybody doing it? And all we hear today, it seems, is how bad the news media are, how biased they are, how inaccurate, how sleazy, how intrusive, opinionated, and untrustworthy they are. It really makes no difference what side of the political spectrum you're on. Those on the left feel the media are a bunch of heartless right-wing hacks, while those on the right say the media are nothing but a gaggle of liberal bleeding hearts intent on bringing socialism to America. It's enough to make me and other journalists turn in our pens and notebooks. So what's the truth? Somebody once said good journalism is a nation talking to itself. I like that definition because it encompasses more than news and daily occurrences. It implies something deeper. It means going beyond the obvious. It means digging beneath the surface to discover what in all likelihood remains undiscovered, or certainly undisclosed, were it not for a relentless, assertive, persistent reporter in search of the truth. As somebody who worked as a journalist for 25 years at the Chicago Tribune before coming to the University of Illinois, much of it as a foreign correspondent in Asia and Latin America, but also as an editor and national correspondent, I saw a lot of exemplary journalism being done, the kind that was a constant validation that what journalists do matters deeply in a democratic society. That journalism is still being done, but with the exception of the annual Pulitzer Prizes, a lot of the work goes unnoticed by a public that has become confused by a new and bewildering array of media delivery platforms, the internet, the blogosphere, iPods, PDAs, cell phones, on and on and on. Now, some would argue that there's been a conscious blurring of the lines between traditional fact-based journalism and the questionable practice of packaging news as an infotainment. And this has resulted in a reading, listening, and viewing public that is unable or perhaps not willing to make a distinction between what it needs to know in order to make informed decisions and what it wants to know, ideas and opinions that reinforce what they already believe, or the kind of fluffy brain candy that permeates so much of the media today. Providing news that the public needs to know is something that I like to call spinach journalism. It's the kind of journalism that says, here, take this, read it, look at it, listen to it. It's good for you. Our two guests today fit that description perfectly. They are freelance journalist Loretta Tofani, whose stories first appeared in the Salt Lake Tribune and elsewhere, and then Kevin Craver of the Northwest Herald in suburban Chicago. Welcome, Kevin. Loretta.
Hey, how's it going?
Thank you.
Very good.
For the record, I love spinach.
I do. Good for you. Before we go much further, I just want to remind our listeners that you're invited to join the discussion by calling 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana or toll-free at 1-800-222-9455 from anywhere you can hear us on the radio or anywhere across North America that you might be listening to us on the internet. You know, let me get things moving by providing our listeners with a little background on the kind of spinach journalism that our two guests are responsible for. Last December, Kevin Craver produced a series of stories entitled Coincidence or Cluster that were the result of a six-month investigation by the Northwest Herald. He spent countless hours poring over more than three decades' worth of documents. He interviewed more than 60 people, including most of the 22 plaintiffs in a pending class action lawsuit. And that lawsuit claims that a plant owned by the chemical company Rome and Haas in suburban Ringwood, Illinois, fouled McCollum Lake's air and groundwater with carcinogenic vinyl chloride, putting residents of the community at risk for brain cancer. Kevin is a senior reporter at the Northwest Herald. He's been with the Herald for about 8 years. He was on active duty with the U.S. Army for 2 years and has been a reporter for about 12 years. Loretta Tufani's story ran last October in the Salt Lake Tribune. Her series entitled American Imports, Chinese Deaths, revealed how Chinese workers are dying slow, difficult deaths caused by the toxic chemicals they use to make products in virtually every industry for export to the United States and elsewhere. She reported that some 100 million Chinese workers were being routinely exposed to a lethal array of toxins every working day, every hour, and every industry. Loretta is no stranger to this kind of journalism. As a former reporter for the Washington Post and the Philadelphia Inquirer, she won a Pulitzer Prize in 1983 for investigative reporting. She also served as Beijing bureau chief for the Philadelphia Inquirer from 1992 to 96. You know, both of these series are excellent examples of the kind of journalism that is being done every day in America, often with little notice. And the kind of journalism that I really want my journalism students to aspire to when they leave the University of Illinois. So what I'd like to do to get going here is to ask our two guests to tell us briefly how they got onto these two stories. So, Kevin, let's start with you.
Well, what happened with us was it was a real bolt out of the blue on April 25th, 2006. This attorney from Philadelphia filed suit on behalf of two people and a third by the weekend. They were two former next-door neighbors, and then when the third joined, they were actually three neighbors in a town of 1,100 people who, within 7 months of one another, were diagnosed with brain cancer. Mm-hmm. Not any old, you know, not any kind of brain cancer, but two very rare forms. We're talking two of them had a brain cancer you see maybe one case per 100,000. And a neighboring factory had for decades been charting a path of contamination from their plant. It was owned by Roman Haas recently, but for years it was Morton International, as in Morton Salt, but they didn't make salt there. And, well, the lawsuit stated that vinyl chloride from that factory and through the groundwater had made these people ill. Of course, the factory, which had been cooperating with the IEPA, denied that. And over the months, more and more people filed suit. There are presently 23 individual lawsuits. 18 of them are brain cancer or nerve cancer. So ours started out right out of the blue. We got a call from our reporter at the courthouse and said, you know, you guys might want to follow up on this. So that's how we got our ball rolling.
Well, how many people all together do you think have been impacted? I mean, obviously the lawsuits may not tell the whole story.
Well, obviously you've got it's kind of weird the way cancer statistics have tracked. There could be more people over the years who have died or have moved out, you know, moved from that village and gone all over the country and died there, and nobody put two and two together. But even if people are absolutely healthy, you know, obviously, if you own a home in that area, the current housing market notwithstanding, you're not, you know, you somebody shopping for that house. All you got to do is look on the internet, and you're not going to be able to give that house away. So even if you're not sick, I mean, there's definitely an impact.
It's reminiscent of something that I remember back in the 70s called the Love Canal in New York.
That's been brought up here in this case. The question isn't. The lawsuits don't allege that there's any really contamination now, but the question is, over almost 40 years of manufacturing operations there, what were people exposed to in the past?
Right. Loretta, you came to these stories in a unique way, not as a journalist, but as a store owner. Can you tell us how that happened and then explain the reporting process that led you to these stories?
Sure. I, after having been a journalist for 25 years and winning a Pulitzer Prize, I moved with my husband to Utah. It was his turn to pick a place to live, and I opened a Chinese ethnic furniture store in Salt Lake City in late in 2003. And so that brought me back to China, where I had been a foreign correspondent and was in and out of a lot of factories there, you know, in selecting the furniture for my store. But while I was in the factories, I was really astounded to see the Chinese workers were spraying, for example, oil-based paint containing lead and benzene without the proper protective gear. You know, no ventilation systems, not the proper mask. In the United States, you need, you know, a mask with oxygen. They would have either a simple hospital mask or a mask with charcoal filters. In the United States, you'd have this ventilation system, and they wouldn't have that at all. So, I, you know, looking at them, I just thought, oh, they are setting themselves up for, kidney disease or various cancers. And, I thought maybe this is just a bad factory. But I went to a lot of factories, and in all the factories I visited, I saw the same thing over and over again in different forms. And by the time I came back to Utah, I found that I had just lost interest in the store, and all I really wanted to do was sit in the hospital library and look up medical journal articles about occupational diseases in China. You know, you never lose really your reporter instinct. And from those medical journal articles, actually, the story was quite clear that the scientists and the physicians in China, had found that occupational diseases were occurring across every industry, and that millions and millions of people had these diseases and were dying. And so I thought, okay, what I want to do is bring more detail to this and trace the people who are dying and their factories to the exports to the United States. And so I figured out a way to get the shipping documents, and then I went back to China and I interviewed I closed my store and I went back to China and interviewed Chinese workers who had these fatal occupational diseases. And then in the shipping records, I looked up what factory they had worked for and what company in the United States those goods were going to. And then I also, of course, talked to the factory managers in China and the business people in the United States about, you know, why were they allowing these conditions to exist when people were dying of these fatal occupational diseases. And I also brought the story home to the consumers. But what was difficult was that I did it as a freelancer. Mm-hmm. And so I really kind of saw the problems of doing this kind of work in a different light than what I would have seen had I been on staff at a newspaper.
Loretta, you had some assistance, right, from one of the investigative reporting organizations, as I recall? Or
yeah, I did. What happened was three papers actually turned me down, they knew me. I was nevertheless not a staffer. So three papers said, no, sorry, we can't fund this. You're not on staff. We like the idea, but we just don't have the money for it. But then I received a travel grant from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting, altogether about $13,000 for travel to China, and another grant close to $5,000 from the Center for Investigative Reporting. So those two grants pretty much took care of my five trips to China to do the reporting for the story. But it was unclear for a while which newspaper was going to actually publish the story. Originally, my old paper, the Philadelphia Inquirer, said that they would publish it. Then a new editor came in and decided that, you know, had not been a party to this deal, and so that. But then the Salt Lake Tribune said it would publish it, And so I ended up being paid $5,000 for a year's work at the Salt Lake Tribune.
Wow.
From the Salt Lake Tribune. So it's not an easy thing to do as a freelancer.
No, it's not. You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about the stories you discovered in China, the problems there. Many of these companies that are doing this work, that are producing products, are doing this as part of on a contractual basis with foreign companies, including, I guess, some American companies. Is that something you discovered or not?
I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, for example, an American company might be outsourcing some kind of a production process in China. Maybe they're making.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
That is the case. You know, the American companies, in most cases, do not own the factories there or don't even have a partial ownership of the factories there. They simply go to the factory, you know, and give an order and buy the products.
Right.
And in most cases, that is what happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, before I go too much further, I want to remind our listeners that you're invited to join the discussion by calling 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana or toll-free at 1-800-222-9455 from anywhere you can hear us on the radio or anywhere across North America that you might be listening to us on the Internet. You know, in journalism, we often talk about impact. What impact does a story or a series of stories have on an issue, a problem, et cetera? And sometimes that impact is obvious, and sometimes it isn't. So what I like to ask Kevin to address first, I'd like to ask, and then Loretta, I'd like to ask you both to address that. What impact have your stories had on this issue?
Depends. We ran a 6-part series on the lawsuits, the information we had discovered about the cases. But the most local impact was about a month into the lawsuits. Our county health department, we're a county of about 300,000 people, so we do not have the resources that a big county does. They decided to do what they called at the time an epidemiology study. And they got the people together, and then they showed it before the county board. And they said, well, we looked at the numbers, and they don't show higher cancer rates, and the contamination isn't touching the village. So this really has no merit to it. The data were 3 years old at the time, the most recent data from the State Cancer Survey, which we pointed out at the time. So they collected data that was collected long before most of the people got sick. And then if you looked at the maps they showed the public, if you were close enough to the front or you had a really good pair of eyes, you would see in the bottom corners of the maps they said provided by Roman Haas. So you'd think that, well, any good reporter has one, I'll politely call it your BS detector, starts going off. And one of the stories shows that I FOI'd all the county's research, all of their emails, all of their correspondence, and one of the investigations concluded that their cluster study was phonier than a $3 bill. And but from an impact standpoint, we got a lot of people who called us and said they were concerned about what was going on in the village. But unfortunately, with government, nothing really happened. The health department and the health board jumped up and down and screamed about the stories, although to this day they have never, ever been able to prove that a single thing in them was wrong. And that's unfortunately where it ended. I don't want to get political here, but when you have I'm a very apolitical kind of guy, but when you have a county board of 24 members, 23 of whom are Republicans, typically it's the media's fault tends to be the end of the argument. That study's they never looked into it again, and there's never, unfortunately, been any attempt to hold them to task for this very sloppy analysis. It gave a lot of people a false sense of security.
Now, as I recall, there was a There was a hearing to see how much how this lawsuit will go forward. What's the status of that?
Okay. The paper let me fly out to Philadelphia, which is no small feat for a 40,000 circulation paper. yes, besides the individual damage lawsuits, there's a class action lawsuit that wants to set up a fund for medical monitoring. One of the companies earlier at the beginning of this year settled. And they obviously said, hey, we had not the smaller company, Modine Manufacturing. Mm-hmm. We had nothing to do with this, but, you know, we want to get this off the books, so they paid into this fund. Roman Haas is still fighting it. The judge had the hearing, and after 2 years, this is just the hearing for certification.
Mm-hmm.
And that could happen soon, where the judge would rule one way or the other, and then, of course, if she certifies it, then it would go to merits. So the legal stuff's not done by any means, but it's still in court, yes.
Wow. Loretta, same question to you. The impact that your stories have had on this issue as you reported it.
Yeah. I'm afraid that it's still developing, but essentially the House Democrats in the House cited this series in supporting additional overseas worker protections in various free trade agreements, in not with China, but you know, upcoming bilateral trade agreements like the Colombia free trade agreement, and Democratic presidential candidates. There were more back then, and some lobbyists devised strategies to prevent China from exporting goods to the U.S. low or no tariffs unless China enforces worker health and safety protections. But those strategies would not be able to be implemented unless there's a Democratic president. And even then, I think there's, you know, certainly a question mark about whether, you know, they would be implemented. But certainly there are, you know, people have figured out ways that we would not allow goods to be imported that came through such a system where there are no labor, no free labor unions, no right to association, and workers dying while they made our products.
Do you Loretta? Yeah. I was going to ask you before I forget. Have your stories had any? I mean, were they? This is going to be an odd question to ask, but I'll have to ask it anyway. Having worked myself in China a little bit, I think I know the answer. Have your stories had any circulation at all? Have they been translated into Chinese? Are they available in China at all?
They're not.
Mm-hmm.
There was an article. The closest thing that happened to a translation was a sort of 800-word article in Chinese written in a column called Washington Observer that went to kind of a limited circulation in China, telling Chinese about the story. But that is very, very different from doing a real translation of the series and providing the real series translated to the Chinese. So I'm afraid that, the answer to that is no.
But yet, as I recall, and looking through the materials of the story, that the Chinese government itself has actually looked into some of these problem areas, didn't they issue some kind of a report about it, saying that there were people at risk in China and doing work they
absolutely
shouldn't be doing?
Absolutely. These conditions are no surprise to the Chinese government. The Chinese government is well aware of it, and in fact, the Ministry of Health at an occupational disease conference in Beijing announced that hundreds of millions of workers were in daily, hourly contact with carcinogens, and 16 million factories were responsible for it all across China. So the Ministry of Health is absolutely aware of it, as is you know, as are the other ministries in China. The problem is that really in China, the goal of expanding the economy and bringing in more foreign investment is seen as a sort of a more important goal than the worker protections, and in conflict with the idea of protecting the workers. And so there's very little enforcement in these factories of the regulations. That the Chinese have regulations to, you know, protect worker health. Their regulations, in many cases, are as strict or even more strict than the American regulations. But the regulations are not enforced.
Wow. You know, I want to remind our listeners once again that you're invited to join the discussion by calling 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana or toll-free at 1-800-222-9455 from anywhere you can hear us on the radio or anywhere across North America that you might be listening on the Internet. You know, both of these stories, and it's interesting, I wasn't actually trying to do this, but both of them seem to have a similar thread that these are health issues that are created by corporations, companies are trying to produce products, or these are byproducts of that process, or whatever. This is, you know, not unusual. It certainly hasn't been unusual in our own country, but in these developing countries like China and India and others that are coming online very rapidly, the byproduct of this economic boom and success that we're seeing all the time is pretty stark and pretty it's difficult to imagine that anybody could not see the problems that would be inherent in producing products that have these kinds of byproducts. In other words, I mean, the whole point of people being impacted by economic success in a negative way is not something that you hear a lot of people talk about in third world countries or developing countries, because, you know, it they fear it might impede their economic development. And it's really a constant battle. And, of course, we saw what happened with the Olympics in China, where they had to clean up the atmosphere quite a bit to allow the Olympics to go forward. And now we're back to another where we were. And then now there's this whole issue in China about a whole different story about these babies that are being impacted by tainted milk products.
Well, we had the same problem here in the States with pet food a couple of years ago.
Right.
It was wheat. It was contaminated Chinese wheat gluten that killed all these pets. So, well, it's an interesting situation, because I don't think people learn from history. The fall of the Soviet Union is an example. Everyone talks about solidarity and whatnot in Poland, but I think actually the environment played a very big factor in why that happened.
Mm-hmm.
Now look at Russia. I mean, it's a big country, but their air's polluted, their water's polluted, their ground's polluted. You saw what happens to, you know, government stability when you have a development philosophy of progress at any cost, and it's just history repeating itself.
We may have a caller or two online here. Why don't we take line one? Hello, you're on Focus 580.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You know, with respect to investigative reporting and the state of it today, and I don't know in terms of, you know, how the funding works for, you know, the process of the reporter or the journalist actually doing the work and getting it out there. But one of the, I think, best outlets today is Democracy Now! And Free Speech Television. I mean, they regularly have on people like Naomi Klein, Jeremy Scahill, Aaron Glantz, people like that who, a lot of their funding comes from writing books on, you know, doing long-form work. It's stuff that doesn't generally get out there on the mainstream media. I'm wondering what other, outlets and sources of funding there are for people who are trying to do this kind of work that doesn't seem to, newspapers don't seem to take care of it, and certainly you're not going to see it on NBC or CBS or ABC.
Well, let me jump in there real quickly, and then I'll give you some of my thoughts, and I'd like to have our two guests weigh in too, if they want to. For one thing, you know, when we talk about media, traditional media, meaning newspapers, network television, radio, et cetera. In the past, there was actual budget set aside for doing this kind of reporting, and it was considered to be a very critical part of the news gathering process. And you would create entire teams of people. I know at the Tribune we had something called the task force, and they would they would be put on a story for a year, maybe 2 years, and there'd be nothing for 2 years, and then that story would break, and then it would be a huge thing. We'd run 20 parts of it or whatever. Yeah, but that takes a lot of money and resources, and I don't believe that a lot of the media today, news organizations today, are willing to spend that kind of money. So what you're saying, I think, is very true. I see a lot of this kind of reporting on the Internet. I see it in the blogosphere. I see it in different areas. My only problem with it, of course, is that I wonder about the vetting process that has taken place in this kind of reporting. And that's one thing about traditional media. There is a very strict, very rigid vetting process within the newsroom to make sure that the stuff that Kevin produces, for example, or the stuff that Loretta produces is being looked at, and is they're looking, asking the right kinds of questions. So I'll shut up now and let Loretta and Kevin jump in.
Well, when it comes to funding, I think actually I managed to last year talk to my editors and get the funding to make these trips. But I think respond to what you had said. I think the blogosphere, I think the Internet's actually a godsend. I mean, there is bad information out there, but there's always been bad information. Look at some of the newspapers that were printed back in the colonial days.
Mm-hmm.
The blogosphere can be great at reporting stories that the media don't have the time to do or don't want to do. And some examples, it can be very good. And on the converse, when we talk about the media have a strict vetting process, well, that didn't stop CBS News from publishing some some memos that were generated on a computer. They didn't stop Jack Kelly at USA Today from making stuff up for a decade. It's
mm-hmm.
just as much as we talk about our strict vetting process, well, we're human just like anybody else. So I've seen some very good Internet journalism, and I've seen some very bad mainstream media investigative journalism that ends up hurting the rest of us.
Right.
Because people don't remember, they're not going to remember Loretta's stories on what's going on in China, which is, very relevant since all toys these days are made over there. What is your kid going to be, getting under the tree? They're not going to remember what I do, but they'll always remember the ones where a reporter found and, like with,
but I think, I think those cases of, blunders by reporters or blunders or, active blunders by reporters who are not being professional and not doing things in a way to substantiate things and to really stay accurate and true, I think that, we are talking about a minuscule number of cases. And whereas on the Internet, these are not professionals generally who are putting this stuff out. There are rules in journalism with newspapers and magazines of, how many sources do you have for something, and did you see it, and did you get the documents, and does it all fit together, and you have an editor who's experienced in, things that don't sound quite right, who asks questions, and you have none of this on the Internet. And so it's really a tragedy in America, I think, that the newsroom budgets are no longer there for real investigative reporting. Yes, they are there at the big newspapers, and from time to time, as you found, Kevin, they'll be there at a small paper. But in general, it's an enormous struggle now to do a worthwhile investigative story.
Those are good points. And we have another caller, I think, online with us. Go ahead. You're online with 580. Hello?
Hi, me? Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just picking up on a couple of the things that were just mentioned earlier regarding the coverage that some of these stories might not get, say, like the previous caller said, on NBC or on ABC, and these networks which have a lot of funding from corporations, right? But for example, you could expect something more from, say, NPR or WILL, which are public stations, which should, and in my impression, should have a little bit less sort of leaning towards stories that benefit the corporations, right? And I don't know how much then this investigative reporting then is affected by, well, who's funding these things, and does it really, is it convenient for them for these things to come out? And not only in these long reports, but also in the day-to-day news, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you see the coverage of the election right now, it's always just about two candidates, whether there are six, right? So who actually decides this vetting process? How is it decided which stories you get on and which stories you don't get on, even on public radio, right? Not on the mainstream media where you get, it's obvious that there's all this sponsoring from these other companies.
Well, those are good points. And, you know, that kind of leads me to another question I wanted to ask our two guests. And then and get to, maybe you could, Loretta and Kevin, give me your thoughts on what you think the state of American journalism is today. In other words, what's right and what's wrong with it today?
That's a very good question. I think. Hello.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I think the trick is going to be what happens with the internet, how that shakes out. I mean, it's kind of weird because every year the rules are being rewritten. We're in the middle of an information revolution that has never been seen before in history, unprecedented. And you know, I think it's kind of premature to talk about the level of it, but maybe I'm getting jaded, but I'm a little pessimistic on it because, well, we talked about this. I mean, times right now are tough for print media, and what I've discovered is, unfortunately, I mean, you know, we had, our stories did generate a lot of local concern about what's going on up in McCollum Lake. But what I've discovered is that in a lot of newspapers, not mine, but when it comes to investigative reporting, you know, the owners of the company don't want to pay for it, and it's a double whammy when it seems like people don't want to read it.
Right.
That's the other thing. I know people who, let's just face it, sometimes, you know, people are going to turn to the Dish page to see what, you know, Lindsay Lohan's doing today.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter that they, you know, might be turning on their tap water and something's coming out of it that might hurt them. That's a secondary concern. So it's going to be interesting how the whole thing shakes out. But also my worry is governments know that the media are hurting right now. We don't have the money we used to, not just for investigative journalism, but for the everyday things. You file an FOI for a document that they're required to give you, and they know that if they say, well, you can't have this, that, you know, we might not be willing to hire the attorney to say, oh, no, it's in the law right here. You have to give it to us. So that's the problem, I think, too. With that lack of funding, I think government's going to know that there's a lot of things that they're supposed to tell us and supposed to give us, and they can start getting away with not doing it because we know we can't afford it.
Well, and there's something else there, Kevin, and already you can pick up on this. Please don't hesitate to do this. But what I find is that governments now, especially organizations, not only governments, but organizations, realize there's another way to reach the public, and you don't have to go through the traditional media anymore. You don't have to have press conferences, which I always found to be almost worthless anyway. But nevertheless, you don't have to do those kinds of things. You can actually do it directly. I mean, you can set up a blog. You can start interacting with people any way you want to and bypass the whole traditional media process. And that's kind of a sea change also that's been taking place.
But that's also, I mean, I don't want to cut off Loretta here, but I'll say for the record that the democratization of the internet is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I'll be honest, I have met a lot of reporters. Journalism is like any other business in terms of, I've known a lot of reporters who I would trust with anything, but I've known reporters who I wouldn't trust to make change for a dollar without a calculator. So I like the fact that, you know, you can go directly to the public with the blogosphere. I mean,
But you will never get anything. I just don't believe that you will get many things of high quality by journalists working on the internet. You know, it requires so much time and so much effort. Who is going to pay the reporter for their time?
Mm-hmm.
Well, oh no, definitely we have a role in it, but you know, I've never been a fan of the idea of the gatekeeper model of information. It's just, you know, the more information, the better.
Right. Well, there's also the watchdog issue. I mean, the idea that the media, the press, as it used to be called, was established to be a watchdog on government and to make sure when something happened that shouldn't be happening, it was reported to the public so the public would be aware of this. Otherwise, it's not going to be made aware of it. You know, and one of the journalists' main mission is to gather information and report it. And I guess one of the questions, Jim, that we could ask here as we talk about this whole changes that are taking place in the world of media, is what role should reporters or journalists play in stimulating discussion of these issues that we're dealing with on a day-to-day basis? And I think that's another legitimate question, is one that you know, we might say, well, that throws us back to the era of declamatory or participatory or journalism, which is what we shouldn't be doing. But I think stimulating discussion, perhaps in a way that's not targeted at one specific political agenda or another, is not a bad thing. What do you folks think about that?
I think that stimulating discussion is very nice, but the problem is what is the issue? You know, a journalist's mission, in addition, you know, as part of the watchdog role, used to be also to identify kind of broken systems that were hurting people,
mm-hmm.
policies that needed to be fixed, that needed to be addressed, and not just writing about these policies in an abstract way, but really reporting the broken system from the ground up. So, for example, finding the murder suspects who had been beaten by the police, and then justice was miscarried, and really tracing that out through many different people and showing how the system breaks down. So that kind of story, or the story I did that won a Pulitzer on men getting gang raped in jail while they were awaiting trial, not convicted of any crime, awaiting trial for drunk driving, shoplifting, trespassing, that, and showing how that occurred through the actual victims and the men who raped them, and bringing a situation to light, that shows a real systemic problem and a need for it to be addressed. That is the kind of thing that we are seeing less and less of.
Sorry, Loretta. I'm just going to. But the byproduct of what you're talking about, I mean, these issues and these stories you're talking about, the byproduct of that is the fact that discussion is stimulated. People do talk about it, and actually, perhaps something can be done about it because people are talking about it. I mean,
But you're not getting the kinds of issues that you used to get. They're vanishing. Those stories are not being done. Even the organizations that now say they want to do investigative reporting are making it quite clear that they want to do investigative reporting that will be, easily palatable for the Internet. So we're going to do a 60-inch story to tell you what's wrong with something. But it's not the kind of, three- or four-part series anymore that really explained a problem through the people who had been hurt and that showed you why all the different agencies weren't coping with the problem.
That could – I understand. Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. With our six-part series, each part also had – a multimedia aspect. So we had both the series in print, and each story ran about 100 inches, and a corresponding video part. So they were both equal, because I can write about a widow crying over the loss of her husband of 40 years, but then you see it on video. But aside from that, I think what we did is the exception and not the rule nowadays. And I with Loretta, I share your concern. It was something we talked about in the Army, that technology is supposed to make you better, not faster. You know what I mean? You give reporters spreadsheet software with which you can take thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of data for a story and distill it into a readable format. But then the thought is, well, now that you have all these fancy gadgets and gizmos, you can crank the stuff out at about 1 a week.
That's a very good point. That's a good point, Kevin. And Loretta, you may, you were in Asia also, but when I went to Asia in 1974, I left with an Olivetti typewriter and lots of paper. And, you know, I would go off to someplace, I wasn't covering Vietnam at the time and Cambodia and places like that, and I would call my office where I could find a phone that was working and say, okay, I'm going to be up country for about 4 or 5 days. I'll call you when I get back. And they say, fine, we'll talk to you then. And I would go off and spend my time 4 or 5 days reporting, talking to people, digesting what I had seen, coming back and organizing it and then putting it into some kind of format that could be, you know, some write it in some way that would be compelling. And I had time to do that. I had time to think. I watch reporters today, foreign correspondents, even former colleagues of mine who are out there doing this work, and they don't have any time at all to think about what it is they're doing. And I think that has really hurt the quality. I'm not saying there isn't good reporting being done in the international arena. There is. But I really feel there'd be a lot more of it if these people had more time to actually assess what they were seeing and digest it in a way that made it palatable, and not only palatable, but really interesting and interesting to read. And I think one of the problems that's happened here is the technology, as you pointed out, is not supposed to make you just faster. It's supposed to make you better. And I think that's what's missing here. Something is wrong with all the way this technology is being applied to our profession.
Well, remember a decade ago, 20 years ago, in newsrooms, you made fun of the people on television. I mean, no offense to them, because like I said, some very good television journalism is still going on.
Right.
But you make fun of it because their concern was get it on the screen now and then get it right later. You know, that's what people watch, the moving pictures on TV, and then they open the paper the next day to, you know, read why it happened and have much more carefully vetted information. But in the Internet era, a lot of newspapers are We're doing what a decade ago was mocked. You throw it up on the web, and hey, if it's right, we'll fix it later. You know, if it's wrong, we'll fix. You know, you see where I'm getting at?
Right, I do. And we have another caller from Edgar County. Go ahead, you're on the air with Focus 580.
I'd like to make a couple of comments regarding the status of journalism. I think that there's probably, and I have no facts recently to back this up, but I think there's more money in PR than there is in journalism. So thus you have a spin factor, which brought me to when I heard that word this morning, spinach.
Mm-hmm.
If you put a hyphen in there, you end up with spin and ache. And I think that is what a lot of journalism has become today.
Well, you know, I'll tell you something, and I'm sure that maybe Kevin and Loretta know this also. If you look at any newspaper, I'm just talking about newspapers, or actually you could include all media, forms of media, about 40% of what you see today has been provided in some way by the world of public relations, either the tip to do the story or some kind of an alert or It's what happens, and so a lot of that is there. It's been created by the world of public relations. But what one hopes is that reporters don't take it at face value; that they actually go out and do their own reporting, and you know, try to get a story that makes more sense than just what somebody's trying to put out, as you point out, in the spin factor. Anybody, Loretta, you want to jump in there, or Kevin?
Just thinking of what's right, you know, your earlier question of what's right with journalism now. You know, I feel like there are actually organizations in the United States that are trying to address the very lean newsroom budgets and the fact that there is, you know, very little inclination to give a journalist time to develop meaningful, important stories that tell us about, you know, policies that have gone awry. And so these organizations like the Center for Public Integrity, the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting, the ProPublica, the Center for Investigative Reporting, they all, you know, are really trying to somehow stimulate what is now missing in American journalism. So I think that's a real positive. But the problem really is that the ones that give grants generally just give grants for, say, travel or expenses, and there's still no one that's providing real funding for the journalists. Or, you know, different models are being tried out, but we're still in kind of an experimental stage right now, so we'll have to see where it goes.
Well, that's for sure. Besides travel, those, you know, I didn't acquire those, you know, about the 20,000 pages and change, actually like 25,000 pages of all those documents. Between my print, my copying expenses and getting the dockets from the U.S. federal court, that was about $1,200, which the newspaper also swallowed. Mm-hmm. So they paid for my plane ticket, but had they not also paid for my account with the district court database, yeah, this it never would have happened. So, yeah, travel's part of the equation. It'll get you there, but, you know, it comes with a price in terms of research and everything.
Well, you know, we're kind of coming to the end of our program, but I just want to, as a wrap-up, say that, you know, the kind, you know, reporting, good reporting is being done. I see it all the time because I'm in the world now where I look for things like that because I'm teaching it now. But even when I was doing it, I read a lot of other newspapers. I looked at a lot of journalism that was being done on television, on radio, whatever, and I could see a lot of good work being done. But even then, I realized a lot of it was going unheralded. People weren't didn't know much about it because it wasn't occurring in New York or L.A. or Chicago and the main, you know, the big media centers of the country. And so I find that this has been a really interesting and stimulating conversation, and I hope maybe we can get you back again and do it again. Our guests today have been freelance journalist Loretta Tufani of Salt Lake City and Kevin Craver of the Northwest Herald in suburban Chicago. Loretta, Kevin, thank you again for spending time with us today, and our technical director has been Jason Croft. Our producer was Harriet Williamson.